It's one of those mornings where people have colds. I noticed Jeff had a little bit of a cold, and I've been sneezing all weekend long. But I'll tell you what, it was a long weekend. Welcome to the Wayne Eddy Affair on this Monday, and it is the 8th day of January, and the year is 2017. And today is the 18th, 2018, correct?
Correct.
All right, thank you, Dan. Here's the deal. I can't remember whether if my father was still alive, if he'd be 100 today or 101 today. I think my mother was born in 18, my dad was born in 17. So anyhow, Elvis Presley was born on this date, January 8th, and it is 2018, a beautiful clear morning, and no breeze, temperature well above zero, and I'll tell you, it was a wonderful day yesterday with 32 degrees, and what I could tell when it warms up is I live out in the country, and I can see a lot of activity of squirrels, and you know that they don't mess around when it's, 10 below zero or whatever. But boy, do they get active when it gets a little bit warmer, out looking for their nuts or whatever else they had buried. And of course, I saw some turkeys on the way in. I bet I saw 15, 16 turkeys. Haven't seen them since the cold snap. And I'm glad to be here and alive and well and have Don Anderson. And Don, if you want to pull that microphone a little bit closer, I sure would appreciate it because then I can hear you better, although you do have a nice distinctive voice. Welcome.
I'm glad to be here.
And are you glad to be here in the studio or just glad to be here?
Both.
Yeah.
I continue to comment on the fact that I'm not 90 yet, but I can see it without a telescope.
All right.
When you get into the upper 80s, you can recognize that there's an interesting decade or two facing the near future.
Well, you know, I often wondered about that because I had I think you know Bob Will, Professor Bob Will from Carleton, the former
yes.
economics professor. I like to refer to as the good doctor, and I've been doing that for over 10 years. And now they come out with a TV show called The Good Doctor. So I thought, hey, maybe I should sue Hollywood, but everybody else is, so the heck with that. And I hope he's feeling well. He hasn't been feeling well, and he's about 90 years old. So how old are you, or is that none of my beeswax?
86 and a good fraction already.
All right. So
working toward 87.
And so you and I are 10 years apart. And here we are.
And it's downhill all the way. I'm cautioning you.
Oh, yeah, I suppose. Well, I've had my downhills and uphills. So anyhow, whatever happens, and, you know, sometimes you think, gee whiz, I'm old. And, of course, a lot of people do. But you know what I found out about being older, if you will, let's say anything over 75? You know what I've learned?
What have you learned?
It that people are just very nice and polite and just nice to you. I mean, I think they say, hey, you know, this guy's been around the block a couple of times. Like they open doors. I'll go into a store and they'll open the door for me. And I'm, you know, upright, vertical. And, well, thank you very much. And a lot of them will say, hi, Wayne, how are you? Of course, I don't know everybody, but it's when you're around this long, you do have people that know you that are in their 30s and 40s that you may have talked to when they were kids. Anyhow, Don Anderson's been a guest of mine on more than one occasion.
Several.
And we always talk about something that's way over my head, right?
Not my challenge, I will have to confess, in thinking about what I wanted to talk with you about this morning was to say how over the radio, can I explain to people some very weird things that are happening in the science of energy area.
And what's your background in that regard? We have to assume, Don, all right, we have to assume that nobody's ever heard you before on the air.
Okay, well, so let's start off by saying that I professed electrical engineering at the University of Minnesota and later helped to start the engineering program at Mankato State. Most of my career, though, was spent in research and development, much of it having to do with solar energy, wind energy. I was at Sheldahl here, a company in Northfield, for a number of years, and became very interested in using mirrors to focus solar energy. One of the things I'm rather proud of is that by now I believe there's something like 38 systems in the world which use power towers. This is a tall gizmo in the middle of a near square mile of mirrors. All of the mirrors focusing sunlight on that one tower, which suddenly is very excited in boiling lots of water or heating other things to very high temperatures to make electricity.
Kind of like when I was a kid, I would get a little kit from a comic book, and it would have a, you know, a 2 cent magnifying glass in there. And then they would tell you, if you take that magnifying glass and aim it at the sun and aim it at a dry leaf, you can start a fire.
I must confess that I used it for something else.
What did you use it for?
I would find a bug, and I must confess that the bug was in a lot of trouble. Now, the big power towers, if a bird were to fly right next to the tower when the sun is shining on it, it would not only be cooked, it would be explosively treated to something like 5,000 times the power of sunlight.
Holy muck. It's, let's see, do the bare roots thing first, and that is, where would the closest tower be that you've participated in designing, or where would one be that we could go look at?
Most of them are in the Mojave Desert, right along the area close to the border between California and Nevada. There's a lot of sunlight available there, so much so that the first system that was built there, only by power standards, tiny, in other words, 10 megawatts of electricity was being generated.
What's 10 megawatts? I mean, I know that's like 10,000.
Yeah, it's a kilowatt, first of all, is roughly what one person demands on average, but not all of it being used directly by that person. Part of it being used someplace in a factory to buy the things that that person wants to buy, and so on. And if you have 10 megawatts, that's enough for maybe 10,000 persons.
Okay, we here at KYMN Radio are 1,000 kW.
That's right.
A radio power. And I once worked at a radio station where the boss put out bumper stickers that said 200,000 watts. And the station actually was putting out FM, putting out 100,000 watts. But because the bays were both vertical and horizontal, he called it as 200,000 watts of FM power. And the FCC immediately said, get rid of those bumper stickers because that's not true. But it sounded good.
Oh, people will try many things like that.
Then there was
in
a,
all fields.
There is or was a station in Mexico that would try to broadcast up into the States, and very successfully, and they were on an AM position, and they had like 100,000 watts. And when you would drive up to the station, your car lights would turn on. And Weird Man Wolf, or whatever his name was, worked on there as a rock and roll jockey. Now, I'm telling you these things, Dan, because what you're going to talk about is probably beyond me and others, but to kind of correlate the continuity of your conversation, I now have an ability to compare.
That's very important.
Okay.
And part of my struggle on this has been that visualizing the size and the intensity of energy production with this new invention is difficult because it it changes our idea of what fire is like. So I want to start off, oddly enough, by going back 300,000 years. Are you willing to go with me?
I do want to do that, but I also want to know, when you say this new invention, in my lifetime, in the last 20 years, or what is new?
The first indication of what's called sometimes cold fusion or otherwise low energy nuclear reactions was in 1989.
Okay.
The inventor that I've been following closely, Andrea Rossi, a doctorate from physics from Italy, started working with nickel, hydrogen, lithium, and other magic sauce ingredients probably around the turn of the century.
And lithium is commonly used in electric cars and in phone batteries and things like that?
That's right. Lithium is in the periodic table, it's a very close cousin to sodium and potassium.
That's salt, isn't it?
Sodium and chloride. Bananas? Sodium chloride, for example, is salt. Sodium itself is a metal.
Oh.
A very soft metal, and you don't want to just let it wandering around, because if it meets some water, even steam on your hand would be enough to do it. It starts a chemical reaction. It's very, very reactive, and lithium is its close cousin in the very first row of the periodic table, which means it doesn't have very many electrons, not very many protons. And it's very reactive. So it makes a great material to make rechargeable batteries. That's the lithium-ion battery.
How is that close to mercury?
Mercury is a lot heavier. And it's also, a liquid metal. Mercury, one of the things that helped me understand, I think, what Rossi is doing, is to think of a fluorescent light bulb. The gas inside such a tube is mercury. And mercury ions, in turn, if you strike a spark from one end to the other of a fluorescent light bulb, produces what's called a plasma. That's mercury ions and electrons allowing current to be flowing from one end to the other. Now, that glow for mercury is in the ultraviolet. So they coat the inside of the glass tube with a phosphor that turns it into visible light.
Well, now, when I was a kid, can't do it anymore, but one of the joys is breaking things. And we would break the, the fluorescent lights.
Yes.
And just to see, hear the noise and see what happened. And there was always this coat of, like, baby powder that would come out of them.
That's
Is that
right.
what you're talking about?
The ultimate thing, of course, is the liquid metal is a shiny, white, flowing metal.
Oh.
And for example, in mercury thermometers or barometers, lithium is a metal which melts and vaporizes very easily. So in the development of this new kind of device, Rossi was trying to find ways to, he is not even sure why it happens, but I believe that lithium and hydrogen combine to make helium. Now, that works great on the sun. That's the way that our hydrogen in the sun turns into helium and produces a tremendous amount of energy at a nice, safe 93 million miles away.
Now, I know that you have a story that you want to talk about and tell. I understand that.
Okay.
And we have a two-hour show.
I'll get it all out. Don't worry.
But I'm going to sidetrack you. Just to bring me into the conversation so I can get a better comprehension
Good.
In reference to what you're talking about. Now, when you say helium, most everybody's going to think about balloons and inhaling helium and talk
Squeak.
Like yeah, Mickey Mouse. And helium was a choice at one time for the blimps. How long have people, do you think, have been aware of and created the use of helium in mankind? I mean, is this something from the 16th century, from the 19th century?
It turns out that Homo sapiens, that's us, mankind, started about 300,000 years ago, and I want to go all the way back there sooner or later.
Okay.
But right now, I'll settle for the fact that we just discovered, for example, oxygen, one of the most important things in air, which causes fire or permits fire to oxidize carbon and other materials, in the middle of the 1700s, just about the time when our country came into existence. Most other gases became known in the following 100 years. So it's the middle of the 1800s before we even knew there was such a thing as helium.
And some guy in a studio, in an experimental stage type university or whatever, is tinkering with stuff and says, hey, look, if I put this and this together, this will make this rise because it's lighter than air. Well, let's call it helium. Or was the guy's last name helium?
No, I think it came from a very early Greek idea that helios had to do with the sun.
Oh.
Helium was the product of the sun. And as we understood that, that got it all started. So, yes, unfortunately, in order to really understand what goes on in detail with this, we think we need to start with understanding what's called the periodic table, where you can stack up in row after row all of the different elements and say, why are these things like other things?
How many are there?
Oh, boy, by now, because we're making new ones up in the high end of the periodic table. Almost all of them are radioactive, unfortunately.
Now, I get the impression that when people... educated people in science talk to each other, that they know every single one of those, and it's all memorized. And I remember in chemistry, I was supposed to memorize so many, and I always... Excuse me.
You did say you had a cold.
Yes.
And now we'll agree.
So I always got the feeling that people that could memorize that periodic table were pretty smart people, and they knew more about what was going on in life. Is that true, do you think?
Without getting into politics, I can say that I have never heard a really smart person say, I am a very smart person, I am a genius, until I heard our president say that the other day. But nonetheless, it is the case that Homo sapiens, that creature that could crawl down out of trees because he didn't have enough fur on him and had no tail, and said, I think I'm going to go live in a cave instead, probably 300,000 years ago was just about as smart as we are. The difference is we stand on the shoulders of people who learn things before us. And as a consequence, by now, we're getting to the point where we are rather proud of ourselves and say we understand almost everything. That's always dangerous, because I feel that Homo sapiens is just coming out of the cradle. I don't know where we're going and what we'll be when we grow up, but we're the things that we're starting to see now, to me, look like science fiction. I happen to love science fiction. I've been reading it ever since I was probably only several years old. And idea that ultimately we'll be able to travel to the stars, ultimately that we'll be able to go almost as fast as, or sometimes faster than the speed of light.
That's fast.
These things all sound like fiction. One of the things about this new Andre Rossi invention, a NASA research person that I know said, this is the invention that will take us to the stars. And that's rather exciting.
Well, yeah, I mean, not in our lifetime, I don't think.
I'm not sure, wow. Considering that we're close to the end of our lifetimes.
Well, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take a brief break, and then I'll let you get on to what you really want to talk about instead of this sidebar stuff that I like to, you know, see
no, but,
if I can
but
keep
it's
up.
All part of trying to help people understand that this, I believe, is the beginning of a huge change for humanity.
Oh, wow. Mm. We're talking big here on the Wayne Eddy Affair. Speaking about big, it's a big anniversary for KYMN Radio coming in September. It'll be 50 years on the air, but been around for a long time, almost as long as the Quarterback Club, located on Highway 3 and 3rd Street in Northfield. It's a beautiful morning. Why don't you take a walk and go down to the QB and have a breakfast before 10 o'clock. They've got anything that you want. And if you want a nice big breakfast, you know, with the... let's say bacon and eggs and potatoes and orange juice. They got malt meal, whatever you want. They have it available at the QB. And remember, it's locally owned and locally operated. The Quarterback Club on Highway 3 and 3rd Street is looking forward to you stopping in for breakfast, lunch, or dinner. And don't forget, you can call in your order and bring it home nice and hot, especially a bucket of their famous roasted chicken.
Residential or commercial, Cannon Valley Water in Dundas is the place to call for water. Whether it's a complete water conditioning system or just salt delivery and filters, Cannon Valley Water can take care of it. And Cannon Valley Water can also deliver Candy Yohai premium water right to your house or business at great rates, too. Chippewa Springs is as pure today as it was when we first tested it over a century ago, and is proudly distributed by Cannon Valley Water. Pickups are now located at 609 Stafford Lane in Dundas, just behind Aldi. Call Cannon Valley for your water today.
Welcome back, 925 on the Wayne Eddy Affair on an absolutely beautiful Monday morning, January 8th, 2018. Be sure you get that right on the checks. And tonight, the Wolves are at Cleveland, and you can hear that NBA game right here on your radio station, 95.1 FM, The One. And, of course, Kim, a friend you can count on, 1080 AM. Don Anderson is my guest this morning, and he has some pretty major thoughts. And I'm going to try to not interrupt you. I know you want to get this thought across. But do you mind, Doctor, if I occasionally say, well, what about this, what about that?
Oh, please do so.
Okay. Now I have a picture of an acreage of mirrors, and they're out in the desert where during the night it's really cold, and during the day it's one of the hottest places on earth near the California-Nevada border, I assume in Nevada. And all of these things, or these mirrors, are pointing at one tower. And when you get to that point at the tower, if a bird were to fly through that beam, the bird would disintegrate completely because it can create an immense amount of heat, even hotter than the sun or similar
close,
to that.
Close yeah. to the temperature
See,
of the
was
sun.
I was paying attention.
Yes,
okay,
thank you much.
So now you're a science guy. You're a... you also are into mathematics and engineering, and you have a mind that can consume these things and comprehend it. But this isn't your professional when you were teaching area. This was something that you've been interested in, science fiction almost, since you're able to read. Okay, so what's going on that we Homo sapiens, as you refer to us, probably don't know what's going on because it probably isn't interesting to most people because they don't comprehend it like myself. But you think we're close to, and by close, decades away from space travel?
First of all, let's talk about who this will be most important to.
Okay.
It won't be you and I, Wayne. We're close enough to the end of our time on this hallowed earth to say, I'll bet I'm going to continue to have a car that uses gasoline. I'll bet my house will be heated with a furnace that uses natural gas. I know that when I flip a switch, the electricity that comes might even be coming from burning coal, or it might be coming from nuclear energy, but it won't be from anything new. That's because when you come up with a radical invention that is explosive in its potential, it takes decades before it's fully developed. For example, Andrea Rossi, the inventor of what I'm calling, we will be calling the ECAT, catalyzed energy system, ECAT.
Okay.
ECAT.
Well, I'm going to spell it phonetically.
ECAT.
ECAT.
And by the way, in particular, if there are older people listening to me who have any younger people who will see this happen, tell them to go on the internet and look up ECAT.com, ECAT.com, and a good deal of information is available starting with one look like that. For example, I have five great-grandsons, the oldest being only in the second grade. In their lifetime, I believe they will, for just as an example, if they want to buy a car when they're old enough to have a car, first of all, it probably won't have a steering wheel, and it probably won't have any pedals on the floor. Robotics and artificial intelligence will reach the point where the car will be able to take them wherever they wish and park itself someplace until they want it to come and pick them up again. But one of the other things now with this new invention, I believe by the time they have a car, the fuel in the car will last for 400,000 miles before it has to be replaced because it finally wore out. That's not the same as gasoline. Obviously, you couldn't carry anything like that. A second thing that my grandsons will, great-grandsons will see by that time is that if they wish to fly, for example, from here to Europe, they'll get on an airplane which can fly back and forth and back and forth and back and forth for about a year before it has to have the fuel in its engines replaced. This is something so different that it will change economics and politics worldwide. So the excitement is my hope that the young people who are either listening or have uncles, aunts, parents listening will say, when you think of STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, as something to focus on, it's because our old fire, in all of its applications, I believe, is obsolete. There is a new fire. And once you start that, that means that almost every device we have has to be re-envisioned using artificial intelligence, robotics, and a new energy source. Now, it's already become the case because of lithium-ion batteries that virtually every car manufacturer in the world is saying by 1925 to 1935, almost all of our cars will either be hybrid or entirely electricity propelled, not by gasoline or diesel fuel. And this will be made even more so with the new invention that allows the recharge energy for batteries not to come from burning coal or natural gas or fuel oil or anything else, but rather this new source. Now, to understand the new fire, I would just love the opportunity to be able to go back now 300,000 years. I'm not sure of the exact age, but about then, yes, there were hairless apes that came out of the tree into a cave.
When you say new fire, are we talking heat?
Heat.
Okay.
That's what happens. It's just a different source of heat.
Thank you.
So we still will have to make steam, to run a turbine, to make electricity, to push it out through wires, all the rest of it, will be rather normal. But, for example, think of a coal-burning boiler used in almost gigawatt sizes to make electricity. Suppose we replace ultimately only the boiler that makes steam with this new source. Suddenly you would have something that can use the existing turbines, the existing electric generators, the transformers, the power lines, everything else. We're just replacing one fire with a different fire. Okay?
Okay.
Now, back to the old fire, just for a moment, in order to make a rather strong point. It's the following. Almost as soon as Homo sapiens came into existence, living in caves, he discovered that it was very marvelous to learn how to manage a fire at the mouth of the cave. That kept big animals away. It allowed him to cook small animals and a variety of things like that. And fire existed naturally from electrical discharge, making fires out of a forest and everything of the sort. There was a very, very long period of time in which fire was used without mankind understanding what a fire was. Remember, I mentioned that it wasn't until roughly the 1760s that we discovered oxygen. Prior to that, they scratched their head and said, well, it's something called phlogiston. It must be some magic thing in burnable fuels, wood, coal, everything else, because when we burn it, it gets lighter in weight, the ash, and whatever went away was what caused the fire. But they didn't know what it was. They didn't have to know what it was to be able to use it. They could make steam engines that ran boats and locomotives. They could learn to start with iron ores and make steel with heat. They could do many things with heat, learning how to manage what existed. Originally, it was almost all wood. And yes, if you look back in the history, for example, it was a great breakthrough in the British Isles, almost out of wood, when they discovered coal. This black rock, hey, I can set that stuff on fire and it makes heat. Much later, we discovered, wait a minute, that black gooey stuff that comes up out of the ground called petroleum, we can burn that stuff. And then they found that there was even a gas coming up out of wells that they could burn. All of these are just different forms of the old fire. Now, given that, one of the problems that Andrea Rossi is having, and so have other people who've been working with this new fire, is that theoretical physics doesn't explain why it works. I've done enough work in areas like this in my lifetime so that I can scratch my head and say, I think I know what the process is, and it might even be right, but I don't know why that process itself can happen. And it's because this is near room temperature, not the temperature of the sun. On the sun, we know how hydrogen can turn into helium. We can't do it at temperatures low enough so that we don't melt everything around us. When Andrea Rossi started doing work with these materials, one of his problems, and it still was until pretty recently, was control. In other words, he melted an awful lot of stainless steel containers, because if he got it to work at all, how do you keep it controllably at a temperature that doesn't melt what it's being contained in? And so the control is a strong part of this. A few years ago, I told you I thought that Andrea Rossi had something new going, and if it was real, it would make a difference. At that time, I was saying, if it was real. Today, I will say he has gone far enough in learning how to control the new fire that I believe by about the end of this year, 2018, certainly in the following 1 year, he will be selling the first units that can be completely controlled and can replace, as an example, the coal burning in a boiler to make steam, which can turn into electricity and all the other things. Right here in Northfield, as an example, we have one place that uses industrial process heat in big quantities. It's to cook cereals. They make an awful lot of steam for that. His first application, he says, will be for industrial process heat. There's a reason for that. It turns out that any place that makes industrial process heat has to have a licensed, authorized, trained operator on present 24/7. So we will not, in the next 2 years, see something being sold to keep our house warm. That will require that it's been in use long enough to get a complete control recognized and authorized for something that can have a UL stamp on it, as an example, and become our furnace.
Now, this new fire is called ECAT?
The ECAT is the name that he copyrighted. The ECAT new fire is copyrighted by Andre Rossi. That's right.
Andre Rossi, does he come to America to study the mirror thing, or does that have anything?
No, it doesn't.
These are different. Okay.
As far as I'm concerned, in the long term, like any other patent I've had in energy, they become obsolete. What's wrong with solar energy, after all? The answer is the sun doesn't shine 24 hours a day everywhere. If I suddenly have an alternative which is less expensive, doesn't have any radiation, doesn't have any radioactive waste, and is far cheaper than, I mean, by huge powers of 10, than burning oil or coal or anything else, solar energy applications will become more and more rare over the next 20, 30 years.
Well, what does it look like? Is it a gas in a chamber?
Think again of the fluorescent tube.
Okay.
Suppose you made a little fluorescent tube, very tiny, no bigger than the end digit of your little finger.
Okay.
Maybe a little bit smaller than that. On both ends are electrodes, just as there would be for my other source of a plasma, which was maybe 4 feet long. There's a ceramic tube around this little bit of space. Ceramic because he's running at temperatures higher than the melting point of stainless steel, higher than the melting point of nickel. Inside this tiny itsy-bitsy thing is a magic powder. And by the way, like if I were the inventor, I wouldn't tell either. I don't know with absolute certainty what's in the magic powder. His patents assert that it includes powdered nickel, lithium, aluminum, and hydrogen. The three of those, a lithium aluminum hydrate, is a particular compound that you can buy if you are a wild, crazy chemist, and which, when it's heated, does produce helium, produce hydrogen as a gas. Now, hydrogen plus lithium on the sun produces helium. So, in the beginning, Rossi didn't have this approach. His first ECATs were things that were so low temperature to control it that he used it just to make hot water or steam, the sort of thing that today we would call normal industrial process heat. That was his low-temperature ECAT. Then he came up with a new one. This was about 8 years ago already, which he called the hot cat. That was a thing, think of something about the size of a cigar, which had a thing, a heater wrapped around it, made out of ceramics. This heater would be used to get it started and to control it. You had to continue to put electricity into that heater, almost enough to get it warm enough, and lo and behold, it would start getting hotter all by itself, up to close to the melting point of stainless steel and nickel. It turns out that at that time, he allowed a group of research people, independent experts, physics professors and the like in Sweden, Switzerland, mostly, one of his units, and 1 gram of this magic powder. The 1 gram, by the way, in a nickel, there are 2 grams of nickel. Just to get an idea of how big a gram is, that's a tiny, tiny amount. It's one aspirin pill, if you will, of that order. Of size, and they allowed that to run red hot, not white hot, because white hot would have melted something, but red hot for 32 days in a row, concluded that the amount of energy coming out of it was much, much greater than the amount of energy that the control system had to put into keeping it hot enough to control this. And that one didn't melt, and neither have others. And they concluded that it had to be something that was not a chemical reaction, but a nuclear reaction, that the amount of energy released was the equivalent of 100,000 times or more the energy in 1 gram of any burnable fuel using the old fire. So they concluded the new fire is real. That's when I started getting very excited. It turns out that one of the professors of physics from Sweden at that time was the chair of the Science Skeptics Society, which says this can't be real, it's a fraud. And they were allowed to make those measurements in their labs, not in Andre Rossi's place. He gave them the powder, and he allowed them even to take and keep a sample of the powder and a sample of the ash that was still there at the end of the 32-day test. So I became pretty certain that it's real. But pretty darned hard to say, how can you control such a sucker as this? Now comes the third ECAT, and this is the one which excites me no end. What he did was to say, instead of having to heat something, suppose I make it tiny, not to make kilowatts in one piece, but so that I can stack many, many, many of them. Think of trying to burn a huge log or a great big lump of coal. The people who were doing that, even before they understood oxidation, discovered that if they broke up the huge log into little chunks, or the huge lump of coal or charcoal or anything of the sort into briquettes, you could control it better. So the ECAT QX, the one that he will go into volume manufacture within a year, I believe, is tiny. It only produces about 30 watts, one of them. But that 30 watts can be produced for a whole year at temperatures up to nearly the temperature of the surface of the sun. It would melt any metal except tungsten when operating that hot. And suddenly it's completely controllable. One of the tests that he has done in the last year was because he has a partner. The partner, obviously, a large company with deep pockets, willing to risk something new. And I don't know who the partner is, and no one else seems to know either. I have a thought or two, but that's neither here nor there. But the partner said, let's prove that we can control this thing by turning it on and turning it off, turning it on, turning it off. They took three of these little thingies, and for a period of, in total, 18 months, turned it on and turned it off. About the cycle that I think they were using most of the time was to turn it on, let it run for 3 seconds, turn it off, wait 4 seconds for everything to stabilize in the off position, turn it back on, turn it off, and do that for 3.5 million times successfully. That's what's called Sigma 5 in fancy arithmetic of saying the probability of it turning on when I want it to turn on and turning off when I tell it to turn off will happen so often that I need not worry about how often it will not turn on. And by the way, if it turns off, apparently there's no damage. It's just that it will melt itself like a fuse going away. So
was it working? I mean,
all of that time, it was producing heat.
Yeah, and to what? Would lights come on and go off, or how does that?
No, this is just the start of the test.
Okay.
Now these units were all made, let's call it by hand.
Well, I am going to take a break, and we'll find out how they did that. Okay.
It's a deal.
Don Anderson is my guest this morning. If this is a little bit over your head, don't feel bad. But it is interesting that your grandchildren or great-grandchildren will be able to jump in their car and go anywhere for 400,000 miles, but I don't know how the tires will work on that.
I love Grandpa's new home. There's so much to do.
That's right. Millstream Commons helps improve the lives of seniors through all kinds of fun activities. Personalized care from a dedicated and well-trained staff, amazing creative meals prepared fresh every day and served in a social setting, live-to-be-healthy fitness classes, private apartments with all the amenities of home, and a place to continue your relationships with family and loved ones. Millstream Commons, your vibrant life continues here.
You'll totally fall in love the moment you taste Subway's 6-inch pulled pork crunch sandwich for just $2.99. Made with tender pulled pork and topped with spicy chipotle sauce and chili cheese Fritos, it's the perfect combination of smoky, spicy, and crunch. But hurry, it's only here for a limited time at participating restaurants. The memories, however, will last a lot longer. Subway, so much sandwich. Additional charge for extras, plus applicable tax. No additional discounts or coupons may be applied.
Here we go with the Love Generation, right? We're talking about a generation that is, you call your great grandchildren, and let's see how this little itty itsy bitsy thing called an ECAT or...
The ECAT QX is the whole name.
Okay. And so now this fellow, Rossi from Italy, ECAT what?
QX.
QX. Is partnered up with some very large corporation, I assume.
Yes.
And they are doing tests. And you were telling us about those tests where they did over a million on and offs, and it was working.
Well, the particular meeting, which I couldn't attend because I wasn't invited, happened on the 24th of November of this year in Stockholm. I remind you that many of the professors who did those earlier tests on the ECAT HT, the hot cat, were from Sweden. Andrea Rossi invited 70 people to a closed meeting, which was all recorded and is available on YouTube. So on the following day, I attended the Stockholm meeting for 4 hours, looking through my computer, through YouTube, to a recording of his demonstrating three of these little tiny thingies inside of a heat exchanger, which was roughly the size of my thumb. There were three of them inside of it. He was pumping water in and allowing it to come out hot. By the way, he was pumping it with what's called a peristaltic pump. Really fancy stuff. It means that it knows exactly how much water squirts through each time something squeezes on a little tube. And this was set up to run exactly 1 liter per hour. Not very much. Remember, these things are tiny. He's going to use billions of them later, but he's only measuring it with three. During that period of time, the water was being collected in a bucket on a scale. The bucket was marked in fractions of a liter, and the scale was weighing the water that came out of it. That was to make sure that ain't no fraud here. All 70 people were invited to come forward while this thing ran for 2 hours, getting their noses within inches of this little heat exchanger and everything of the sort. It turned out that the ratio of the electricity required to control these three thingies producing about 23 watts in the setup that they had there was roughly 1/500th. Of the heat energy coming out. So what we have is something like a fluorescent tube where at each time they turned it on, and they were turning it on for 3 seconds and then off for 4 seconds while it was still producing 23 watts out of three of them, work the arithmetic, and let's say that each one of them probably will be rated when it's being used at something over 20 watts. continuously white hot, and I mean white hot, so that there is light coming out of it, being absorbed, of course, inside this little heat exchanger around it. And lo and behold, when they finished that, with everybody allowed to come up close, look at the oscilloscope, look at the meters, look at every wire, every place, the applause was overwhelming. And one of the things that he announced within one day after that is that, yes, now I have full commitment to build two new mass production robotic factories. Again, I want to take a side walk for just a moment to help people to understand what a robotic factory is. Think of the machine gun. When the machine gun was invented, well before World War I, one thing that had to be invented was a fully automated factory to produce machine gun bullets. If you're going to have thousands and thousands of machine guns along a battle line, you're going to use up billions of pieces of ammunition. And this little thing, the ECAT QX, he says now will be manufactured in huge quantities, will be manufactured in a completely robotic factory, so that billions of these tiny things will come out. And the way in which the world that says, what do I do with a new fire, the challenge will be to start stacking these things in huge numbers with control, so that they in turn can produce usable big quantities indeed. One of the things that Rossi has said, and one of the things that he does respond to some questions on the internet, is that the size that he will offer first will be 500 of these 20-watt units in a thing that is a heat exchanger. The idea being that for 1 year, it will produce then 10 kilowatts. When you go 20 watts times 500, 10 kilowatts, by the way, in terms of heat output, would be enough to heat my house. How big would it have to be? I've spent some time thinking of this. Think of a flashlight. Now, leave both ends open and threaded. In other words, it's a piece of pipe, but it's about the length of a flashlight and about this big around. That would be my new furnace someday. Able to keep my house warm, able to make all the hot water I want for hot water heat or hot water to take my shower in or anything of the sort. The size of 500 of these things will fit in something that small. To go even further, he says the first units that I will be offering for sale as soon as I can demonstrate the robotic factory at production quantity is 1 megawatt. A megawatt is 1,000 kilowatts. If 10 kilowatts would keep my house warm, that would be 100 houses. Or for a factory using industrial process heat, 1 or more megawatts would be kind of common. Now, years and years ago, when I was first working with solar energy, everybody's dream was to get solar cells to the point where a solar cell could be produced at $1 per rated watt. $1 per rated watt. Why would that work out? Well, let's say it's going to last for many, many years, and that roughly in a sunny location, tracking and everything, you might get a couple thousand hours per year of sunlight on it. Remember, it gets dark at night. It doesn't work then.
As you say that, the sun is beaming in on you.
All that time.
Don Anderson is my guest this morning on the Wayne Eddy Affair, 3 minutes away from 10 o'clock and the news, and I throw it back in your court, Don.
Okay, we'll continue to chuggle as hard as we can, and I'll try to look into the future in the second hour a bit with your assistance.
Okay.
I ain't never been there before.
Well,
neither have you.
where does a guy go to buy some stock in this company?
I have a form on my desk right now.
Really?
For an NDA, which means if I sign that, I hope to be one of those who will be allowed to get involved. He has incorporated. The corporate name is listed on or shown in that ecat.com is Leonardo. It turns out he's from Italy, and Leonardo da Vinci was quite an inventor himself sometime.
Oh, yeah.
After all. So he says that when I am selling from the first two factories using insider money, then IPO, industrial initial product profit.
I know what you. It's an
IPO. It's when it publicly issues.
Right.
Then Leonardo will have an IPO. So it won't be until the beginning of 2019 at the earliest, I think. But the point being that two factories won't make enough to change the whole world. Factories in every state in the United States and equal numbers of them in all other countries will make all other old heat obsolete in 10, 20, 30 years at the most.
And, of course, the politics are going to become involved in wars.
Economics, politics, wars, all of those things will be impacted by such a radical change in availability of energy.
Well, it sounds pretty much different than what we're doing right now. And would that replace then the windmills that we've got here in Northfield, two at Carlton, one at St. Olaf?
Probably not. And the reason will be, if you look at all things that use fire and say, suppose we have to capitalize replacing everything that's obsolete, the fraction of the gross national product worldwide that we probably can invest in that is no more than 10%, some piece like that. And that means it will take 20, 30 years before all old sources of energy will become unusable.
Obsolete or unusable?
Obsolete is a better word than unusable, where you've already invested in them, you'll keep using them until they die.
Okay. It is 10 o'clock. Don Anderson is my guest here on the Wayne Eddy Affair, and we're talking about the future, and we are going to find out what the past was by way of a newscast here on the 95.1 FM and 1080 AM for nearly 50 years, KYMN.
China Sea, Golden Globes protest. I'm Evan Haining. Thick smoke continues to billow from a burning oil tanker that collided with a freighter in the East China Sea late Saturday. Three countries have pitched in to help search for survivors. Correspondent Matt Rivers says this could be an environmental disaster.
We know that some of the oil on board has already leaked into the surrounding waters. We're not sure how much, but of course if there is an explosion and a subsequent sinking of that vessel, that could make that environmental situation even more treacherous. That's compounded by the fact that the kind of oil that is on board this ship is an ultra-light crude oil.
It's called condensate and is more toxic and more flammable than crude oil. Warmer weather is on the way, but meteorologist Pedram Javaheri says for now, a winter weather advisory remains in effect for much of the country.
About 82 million people now underneath this include some of the major metro cities of the Midwestern U.S., and that's one in every four people that are going to be dealing with some sort of wintry weather, at least over the next 24 hours.
39 new low temperature records were set in the Eastern U.S. yesterday. At last night's Golden Globes Award, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri was named Best Motion Picture Drama and Lady Bird Best Picture Comedy. And calling out sexual harassment and misconduct were the real stars.
It was a night of common ground against sexual harassment, where the Time's Up movement and those in support articulated best, say many, by Oprah Winfrey, who took home the Cecil B. DeMille Award.
There isn't a culture, a race, a religion, a politic, a workplace that hasn't been affected by it.
On the TV side, The Handmaid's Tale was named Best Drama Series, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, Best Comedy Series. Backstage at the Golden Globes, I'm Jim Roop in Beverly Hills.
A secret government satellite is orbiting the Earth after a successful launch by SpaceX last night. The Zuma mission blasted off from Cape Canaveral. Sonic booms echoed in the sky as the first stage booster returned to the launch site a few minutes later. The Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ futures are lower right now. I'm Evan Haney.
let me out till 2:45. Would you lock the door? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Wayne Eddy Affair. I chose that as a theme song 12 years ago because my first radio station that I worked at was in 1964, and somehow, some way, some lady contacted me and said that she remembers her girlfriend and one of the young ladies I was dating at the time drove me to Tomah, Wisconsin, because I didn't have a car, and the first time I went there, I took the train. Boy, I'm getting old, huh? How about that? But I have to tell you what's happening in less than an hour. At 11 o'clock, our landscapes push aside wildlife and in turn diminish our genetic program love for wilderness. So how can we get ourselves back into balance through gardens to speak life's language and learn from other species? Terry Knight's guest today on 15 with the Author is Benjamin Vogt, who poses the questions and proposes answers in his new book, A New Garden Ethic, Cultivating Defiant Compassion for an Uncertain Future. That's at 11 o'clock this morning on 15 with the Author with Terry Knight. Sounds like after our show we're going to get into something else that's, going to help the earth. So, once again, Don Anderson, Dr. Don, is in studio right now, and he's got something that he's very interested called the ECAT QX, an invention by a guy named Rossi over in Italy, and is supposedly, imagine this now, folks, close your eyes, you pull into the gas station, but you don't pull up to a pump, you pull up so you can go in and get a candy bar. Because your car is being fueled by this ECAT system, and it's going to go 400,000 miles before you have to insert a new one. The package is standard square foot, maybe about the size of your car battery, and that will take you 400,000 miles. Amazing. Hard to believe, and do you believe?
Do you believe?
You believe?
I believe, yes. Let me back off just for
sure.
A bit to explain why, while I haven't tested one of them myself, I've been able to read the test results of the 32-day test of the high-temperature ECAT that preceded this one. I was invited myself, as many other people have, to look after the fact at the recording of the four-hour demonstration of the QX in Stockholm, my background included my PhD work way back in the days of the vacuum tube. Lo and behold, the Navy had gutted a battleship, the center part, in order to put a fire control computer in it with vacuum tubes. And on those rare occasions, I was told, when all of the vacuum tubes worked, they could put a shell almost the size of a Volkswagen Beetle in a pickle barrel 20 miles away. But almost always the vacuum tube failed, some one of them. So I spent 4 years being paid by the Navy and through grant doing research on how to make very long-lived vacuum tubes. Vacuum tubes use nickel, which happens to be one of the magic ingredients of this. Impurities, ultra-high vacuum pumping, getting rid of helium going through glass walls of the vacuum tube, all of those things were things I worked on way back when I was young. And as a consequence, I can look at this and say, I still am not sure why it works. But as an engineer, which is different than the scientist in me, if it does work, I look at it and say, okay, let's use it. Now, if the mass-produced little cartridge that I refer to can be made for the following price, think what would happen. The numbers that I give you here are numbers that Andrea Rossi says are their goals in putting together this robotic factory. He says that the cartridges themselves, that's not the only cost in building a complete energy system. After all, you have to have the heat exchangers, you have to have the controls, you have to have turbines, you have to have generators, all the rest of this. But the little cartridges that you have to replace, recycle and replace back to the factory after roughly 1 year if you run 24/7, which is about 8,000 hours. The cost of that, he says their goal right now, which they hope to meet within a year with these first robotic factories, is to be able to produce the QX units themselves for $10 a kilowatt. Now, if they are rated at 20 watts apiece, that's 50 of these units. $10 a kilowatt means each one of them is 20 cents. 20 cents for something about the size, remember, or smaller than a 22 caliber bullet.
Okay.
And by the way, those things in the high volume are in that same range. He also says that after it's been used for a year, they have to design the heat exchangers and everything so that they can pull out, extract these little guys and send billions of them back to the same factory where everything in them can be recycled and used and replaced. The replacement cost that they are working on is $1 a kilowatt. Now, if you can run for 8,000 hours at a kilowatt, 8,000 kilowatts for $1 worth of new fire. That is such a tiny number, it's roughly 1,000th the cost. I wrote down the number, let me look it up. The fuel cost will be 1/1,000th the cost of the cheapest oil being used today. That will change economics worldwide. It doesn't mean that today's oil won't all be used. After all, it's a finite resource. It'll be used more slowly for petrochemicals, for lubricants, for many other things. Oil companies, the oil-producing companies, are very concerned, I know, because there's something called double-entry bookkeeping. Now, a short, very short lesson in economics. If once a year a large oil company has independent CPAs, certified public accountants, look over all of their books. Suppose they discover that the biggest asset that they have is oil still in the ground. And suppose they know that the Rossi invention is being volume produced and threatens to be doubled and doubled and redoubled in the next few years. They will decrease, on paper only, the value of that asset. Now, with what's called double entry bookkeeping, and yes, I had that course way back when too, it turns out that while the oil company that year may have been selling barrels of oil at, say, $50 a barrel, they may have been very profitable in selling at $50 a barrel, but they have to take as an operating loss the decrease in that asset. And suddenly they're losing money. No self-respecting CEO, no board of directors wants to see that happen. One of the problems that I know that Andre Rossi is facing is just what you would expect. When you threaten the most valuable asset of some of the largest corporations on earth, there is a strong, strong tendency to say, how can we slow this man down? It turns out Andre Rossi originally, or about 4 years, 5 years back, signed an agreement with a venture capital firm in the United States, set up in Miami, Florida. That is, by the way, where he plans to build one of his two automated factories, one in Florida, the other one, I believe, southwest of Stockholm. I don't know exactly where. But nonetheless, they paid him $10.5 million for a down payment of something that was supposed to be followed with another roughly $90 million. And at the end of the year in which he tested one unit for one full year running at 1 megawatt, lo and behold, they didn't pay him because they didn't have that much money available. Well, it turned out that the lawsuit slowed him down for about a year and a half. And I have a strong feeling that the primary reason was that their real purpose was not to help him, but to slow him down. Now, he won that lawsuit in an out-of-court settlement. He got back all of the patent rights to all of his patents worldwide. And that makes the economics something that we'll have to watch as time goes on.
One of the things that I think you and I probably have heard throughout our lifetime is that there are well-educated individuals that will swear that there are gasoline-free cars that can run on something, and that the government wants the federal tax on the gasoline. And so the patent offices diss these people, and they keep these people from manufacturing things that would put the oil business out of business. So is it your thought or our paranoia that as long as 3 decades ago there were people claiming that there can be automobiles powered by something other than going into the gas station, but they're being held back?
I, of course, don't know with any certainty. All of us are subject to access to fact or fiction through the media. Today in particular, considering our national politics, alternative fact is a frightening word. I thought the old word that I was perfectly reasonable was called lie. But it doesn't seem to be for some people. And I'm looking into the future now, starting to saying, what problems are there, given the fact that I am no longer saying if this thing is real. I'm saying it is real. They're attempting, they seem to have the funds to build a first set of factories. They, I believe, will start by offering industrial process heat only. Maybe what they'll really offer is not to sell the units, but rather to send a sealed unit and sell the heat to industrial users at the beginning. Anything to attempt to hang on to the knowledge of technology and to minimize the number of ways in which they can be stalled out by lack of license to sell a product, to inspect the product, to test the product some more, all of those other things that you can do. Yes, in my lifetime, I've been involved in some things that involve getting UL certification of a new product. It's hard, and it should be, because the UL certifies that this is safe under Underwriters Lab.
Okay.
It's one of nationally, and there are other comparable units in Europe, Canada, and so on. But if you are going to have an independent testing lab certify your product as being safe to use as packaged and with the instructions that come with it, they have to be careful. That's why I don't think I will see a new furnace the size of a flashlight in my house in my lifetime, because I don't anticipate seeing home use or probably use in a car in less than, say, something like a decade at minimum.
Is there any other than magazines that most people never heard of, is there any major media that are covering the success of their invention?
First of all, there are two books that have been published, one in Italy, called ECAT, The New Fire, by a woman who spends most of her time describing Andre Rossi's background, because he's invented other things and been in jail when he apparently tangled with the mafia in Italy and things of that sort. As I understand the mafia, that's almost a sign of positive reaction. Be that as it may, that book is becoming obsolete already. There is a book by a Swedish journalist called An Impossible Invention, which doesn't cover the QX. The author, and I'm going to have to tell you because my ability to pull up a name out of the air is not perfect. I can't remember the author, but the AnImpossibleInvention.com is on the internet, and that's well written and describes that 32-day test in some detail as an example. But in the United States, and I think the reason is managed news, there has been virtually no coverage. You can easily turn to and find a number of well-qualified theoretical physicists who will say it must be a fraud because we don't know why it works. I remind you of that man in the cave starting to use fire when he sure as heck didn't know how it worked. But nonetheless, we're all human, and people who are theoretical physicists are human, and they have egos. And if you don't understand something, there are two possibilities. Either it's real and your knowledge isn't adequate, or it's a fake. And so far, in the United States, that's been the case. In Russia, as an example, they're at the point where the Russian government is paying research physicists to do work. They're having national or international conferences on the Rossi effect, where they try to duplicate his results, looking at his patent. They don't know what his magic sauce is, so they haven't managed to get the QX quality performance yet. But they're getting a lot of emphasis. In Japan, as an example, Nissan, that's a car manufacturer that sells, among others, the Nissan Leaf, which is an all-electric car. They are saying, we have already decided we're going to start providing the Rossi effect as a heater in electric cars. We don't need even to make electricity to start getting an advantage, because in cold weather, our climate would be an example, if you have an electric car and try to keep your car as warm as you'd like it to be, your battery wears down about twice as fast as it would in the summertime. So they've already said they presumably are going to license from Rossi Patents. The fact that Rossi's patent was issued in the United States surprised the dickens out of me, because for years, as you said, the patent office had said anything that purports to be perpetual motion will not be allowed a patent. And perpetual motion includes any cold fusion or LENR. They didn't allow any of them. And his came along. And he doesn't claim the magic sauce. He says there is a catalyst, but he does describe the package that he puts together and what's in it, including nickel and lithium aluminum hydrate.
And never claims perpetual motion.
And never claims perpetual motion.
22 minutes after 10 o'clock on the Wayne Eddy Affair, my guest this morning is Don Anderson. He's a retired professor, Dr. Don Anderson, and we're talking about ECAT, QX, an invention by Andre Rossi in Italy starting back in 1989, and it's coming to fruition according to some of the writings that you'll find on magazines and also demonstrations on YouTube, where 70-some educated scientists came to see a demonstration of this little thing that can heat your home. It's about as big as the coffee cup I'm holding in my hand, you know, the kinds that keep your coffee warm. And that would be quite a deal, and unfortunately, my guest and I probably will not be able to see that, because it's years away, and years away ages us, and aging will kill you eventually.
It's been known to do that in the past rather regularly.
One break here on the Wayne Eddy Affair. And we're going to do that in just a second on The One. We are The One, 95.1 FM. And, of course, don't forget we are at 1080 AM and have been there for almost 50 years.
This is Chris Canelli with Northfield Construction Company. We have been building and remodeling homes and commercial projects in the Northfield community for the past 40 years. Whether you are thinking of building a new home, expanding your business, or undertaking an interior remodeling project, Northfield Construction Company has the experience and know-how to handle your construction needs. Call Northfield Construction today to discuss partnering on your next project. 507-645-8975.
Thank you, Chris. I want to have him in as a guest in the immediate future. Speaking about guests, tomorrow's guest is going to be Tom Neville, and he was a guest of mine about a month ago, and there were a lot of questions I did not ask him that I want to ask him. Tom Neville retired as a judge last Friday here in Rice County, and he served for a dozen years as a state senator representing his district, always losing the election in Northfield itself, but being able to gain office through his GOP nominee efforts. So let's get back to, I was going to say reality, and I don't know why I was going to say that. We're checking out something that is going to be eventual, and not in our lifetime, but perhaps in the grand or great-grandchildren's lifetime. And we're talking about ever since fire was invented, what, 300,000 years ago or 3 million? Or
300,000.
When Homo came.
They've already found evidence of cooked bones and food residue from around 300,000 years ago.
The Homo sapien taking advantage of fire, which more than likely started in the forest from lightning. And peat moss, maybe even that kind of kept them warm. But this thing called ECATQX can be studied on YouTube or on the Internet and in books. And my guest here, got to ask you this. What's going to happen, in your opinion, and you're a studied individual, you know more than most of us, about mathematics and science and engineering and all of that. So what's going to happen to the cure-all nuclear energy?
First of all, the nuclear energy that we developed back in the 1940s because of wartime, how can we beat it, beat the Germans, the Nazis, how can we beat the Japanese to having nuclear energy? That nuclear energy was what's called fission. Fission means you're breaking apart a big molecule, a big atom, a big nucleus, like uranium-235, like plutonium, which we had to learn how to make, everything of the sort. The problem with that, when it first came out, by the way, I graduated from high school in 1948, which means my physics class was 47. And remember, the war ended with nuclear explosions in 45. We were terribly excited about that new source of energy. Hey, you'll be able to put it in a box with two wires on the top and get all the electricity you want. We weren't aware at the time of the danger that the radiation from it and the radiation in the waste from them together would be. And as a consequence, early in the game, we were even saying, hey, we can build a new Panama Canal by just a row of atom bombs across the isthmus between North and South America. Then we started trying some of these things and discovering that people up and died from radiation damage, and that one little box had to be surrounded by tons of lead. We did make things like a submarine that could, if the crew could last, go underwater and stay underwater under power for a whole year.
And the only thing that they needed to come up
before was food.
Food was the limit.
Because they made their own water. I had the pleasure of boarding the USS Minneapolis-St. Paul atomic submarine.
Okay.
Down in Fort Lauderdale, and I was taken for an overnight cruise and experienced life in a submarine on a overnight.
You didn't have to stay down for a year.
No, 24 hours. I did not get, what do you call that when you're afraid the walls are coming in on you?
Yeah.
I did not. Kleptomania. No, that's stealing. That's stealing. Kleptomania, you steal. But, come on, our old minds didn't come up with that word. There's a
not if I'm looking for it.
Hundreds of people are yelling at the radio. That word, you're looking for it. Anyhow, that ship was taken out of the Navy and retired. And you wonder what they did with all that nuclear stuff.
Because it will be radioactive
for
centuries, for yeah. century after century. So the huge difference with the Rossi effect is that there is no radiation outside of the tiny little individual QX units itself that can be measured at all above the just natural background of radiation that's always present on Earth. And there is no radioactive waste when you open them.
So how are people going to use them as a weapon?
It will be used, I'm sure. Let's go all the way back to Leonardo da Vinci.
Claustrophobic.
Claustrophobia is much better than kleptomania.
Yeah.
Claustrophobia. Now we can get out of the submarine.
Okay.
All we had to do, and I know the same thing, is to stop reaching for that name, and then it'll pop up.
Yep.
But if you're reaching for it, it won't come.
Yep.
But we saved a lot of people getting in touch with you later, Wayne, by that time.
So the point was is that nuclear power was going to be the greatest thing that ever happened on Earth. Then we found out that the fallout and the radiation is very, very harmful. Then we have the Three Mile Island incident.
TMI was the one in Russia.
Terrible.
And the one that started with the tsunami in Japan.
Yep.
They've had three nuclear reactors make huge areas radioactive forever.
And I think that the Russian one, Chernobyl.
Chernobyl, right.
Yeah. That one, I think, brought people to believe how the invisible damage that it can create. I mean, you still go there now today, and it tick, 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 ticks. And I don't know. Whatever, did you ever find out how that Japanese one turned out ultimately?
It hasn't turned out yet.
So
Fukushima is the name there.
Have they been able to go
to Chernobyl?
In
they, by now, have robotic devices that are going in and attempting to extract the fuel rods and things of this sort so they can take them someplace else and store them forever, which we have to do with radioactive waste. One of the big problems there has been that water, underground water, is flowing into the ocean off Japan and making the ocean mildly radioactive already, and it's still adding to that radioactivity. So the looking into the future with this different source, one of the most important things, in addition to economics, is the fact that it seems that there is no danger from radioactivity of either the process or its waste. And that, of course, it turns out that on Rossi's page, that was ECAT.com, that I told you really is the home page of Leonardo Corporation, he says in that the fuel reserves on Earth at our present use of total energy use is enough to last for 10 billion years. It doesn't mean it will last that long because I know mankind. As an example, I have a perfectly good patent on a way to make windows much more energy efficient. I'm not working at all anymore to try to market that. because as these new sources come online, people will say, what's the big deal? My heat doesn't cost that much. And suddenly you will see people using more heat than we have in the past. How about heating all of our roads so that ice is not a problem? So while carbon dioxide production will no longer lead to global warming, we, Homo sapiens, will always find a way to make a mess out of anything we can.
Now, being that you're a scientist and a doctorate degree in engineering and science and all of that, and you read it all the time, and so therefore you're self-educating yourself as
always
we progress in years. So my question is, what do you think of Al Gore inventing the internet and talking about all the damage that's being done by global warming?
First of all, right now, we in Minnesota and we all over the United States descend. Wait a minute, what this global warming nonsense? We're setting records for the coldest winter ever. The total average heat gain of the whole Earth this winter is still positive. It just turns out that we happen to get the short end of the stick when it came to weather patterns. Climate is global. And as an example, I suspect that because the North Polar region, well, back to submarines, the very first submarine, nuclear submarine, of Admiral Jaime Rickover's Navy was the Nautilus. One of its first trips was under the ice pack at the North Pole, carefully measuring everywhere how thick is the ice, because we had a Cold War going on and we might want to be able to break through in order to launch nasty missiles from near the North Pole. By now, there is open water, many of the places where they made those measurements. The average ice coverage near the North Pole is down by way over 50% in that short period of time. That's changing the climate worldwide. After all, the sun shining on open water in the summertime, when the sun shines 24 hours a day at low angles, is completely different than the sun shining on ice and snow. So that area warms more than it would normally. In addition to the global warming envelope of carbon dioxide up high in the atmosphere. So we may reach the point, and this is something I try to read about, and I don't understand everything I know about it. There is even an issue where some people forecast that so much fresh water will be generated near the North Pole that it will upset the circulation of the Gulf Stream, which goes by the United States and heads up and wraps around the Great Britain and comes back down again to pump heat from the tropics up to Europe. And we may end up being setting up the standards for an ice age in Europe while we may be becoming a hot desert here. Once you start global changes in climate, we don't know necessarily what the future holds. I do know that if we have suddenly a billion years worth of energy available to us, we'll find ways to mess up and hopefully at the same time ways to control. A good example is that do we want to lose Florida? Almost all of it. Because as ice melts, because of global warming, both Arctic and Antarctic, and all of the glaciers, all of that put together tend to say that sea levels may rise 10 feet, dozen feet, pick your own number for something, and certainly within 100 years it'll be at least that much.
We have a show on the first Wednesday of the month, I believe, with Alan Anderson.
Yes, I know him well.
And Bruce Moreland.
Right.
And they talked about global warming. Okay, here's an uneducated guy in the field of science. That'd be me. And I'm thinking, well, when I read about the
topography of the world, or saw it, or was taught it. And they had the Great Ice Age, which brought our lakes. Our Great Lakes were made from...
They were made from a glacier.
Right. And so it happens. It happens. And I've read or heard or saw where some tropical areas at one time weren't so tropical. And some areas... So I'm in the belief that that just happens. That's nature in the world. What can I do by turning off my lights? I mean, I have said this before, and I'll repeat once more. I'm going to talk about Al Gore, the prophet of global warming.
Right.
Who boards his huge jet personal airplane from his huge, beautiful home and flies to some place to give a speech, and then flies to his other huge home, and he's telling me to turn off my lights and do something about global warming when his footprint of use of energy is 1,000 times yours or mine.
Way back,
I just like to complain.
Yeah, way back in roughly 1964.
I know that year.
I was a professor at the University of Minnesota at that time, electrical engineering.
A young guy.
And I was teaching a course in new and alternative energy sources, solar cells. Most of the focus, of course, at that time was because of satellites. There was a need for things. You can't have an extension cord that wraps around the whole Earth. You've got to pick it up where you're at.
And you worked for a company eventually that made the first American satellite. After Sputnik, we had Echo
right.
1.
Echo 1, then Echo 2, Echo Pegasus. I can now say, with I don't think anybody going to stop me on this, that in total we launched 34 aerospace inflatables, of which 31 were classified. There was a Cold War going on,
yeah.
And one of the issues always is how can you make it more difficult for a potential enemy to identify our reentry vehicles if you send 9 decoys along the same general path, and they all look alike at every way you can look at them. And we did quite a bit of work on that.
Think
sort
they're still
end.
Up there? Any of them?
I'm not sure. Pagios lasted a long time during all the period of time that I was at Sheldon. It was still high enough and had been stretch-formed so that it was still going. But that was a lot of years ago by now. I'm sure they're down.
Every time I think about Echo 1, there was a fellow there that was kind of in charge of taking them out of the factory and bringing them to wherever they go and helping in the launching and all that. Real nice guy, and I'm not going to remember his name.
Neither am I.
I think he at one time, he or his ex-wife owned the car wash over by Ziggy's. So his name is somewhere in there. We'll take a break, and we're going to come back and continue our conversation about things we don't understand or we're learning about. That's a better way of putting it.
At Harry Brown's Family Automotive, everything is based on Brown family values, like being friendly, professional, and involved in the community. Right now, we've got a huge selection of vehicles, all American-made, every one of them. Check out that new 2017 Chevrolet, GMC, or Buick you've had your eye on for a while now. Also, we always make sure to peel off every inch of that sticky new car window sticker for you. Harry Brown's Family Automotive in Faribault. Online at harrybrownsgm.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Wayne Eddy Affair. Don't forget, coming up at 11 o'clock, our landscapes push aside wildlife and in turn diminish our genetically programmed love for wilderness. How can we get ourselves back into balance through gardens to speak life's language and learn from other species? Terry Knight's guest today on 15 with the Author is Benjamin Vogt, who poses the questions and proposes answers in his new book, A New Garden Ethic, Cultivating Defiant Compassion for an Uncertain Future. That's at 11 o'clock this morning on 15 with the Author, heard every week on Mondays.
What do you think about that show coming up, huh? Do you think this guy's got something in mind that is not far-fetched, but as far in the future as you're thinking?
Well, one thing that I have noticed, and I believe it was a charter school of some sort, where I heard them advertising the fact that we emphasized STEAM, STEAM, which was science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics.
Wow.
And I think we all will agree that the arts, all of them, ranging from agriculture through fine music and the rest, is part of life that we would like to look forward to continuing to have and continuing to enjoy.
I know a couple of guys that work for Carleton College, and they there's many of them. I don't know how many, but I know a couple that run the steam plant over there. The one that if you're driving north from, let's say, Dundas, and you're driving north on Highway 3, you look straight ahead, and there's this tall chimney. And by the time you get to Highway 19, or let's even say 2nd Street, that thing is far on your right. And you go, oh, there must be a little bit of a turn on Highway 3 you don't see. I don't know, I just observed that. But anyhow, they work on that chimney and the steam that provides for various things and all that. You're going to put these poor guys out of a job if this Rossi, Andre Rossi from Italy, comes up with his ECAT QM, or QKX, rather.
That's one of the things, if you look into the future and say economics and politics and warfare, will all be impacted in a variety of ways. There is no question that what we used to call manufacturing jobs of the old-fashioned kind of manufacturing has already been heavily impacted by robotics and will continue to be more and more so. And it isn't the case that you can suddenly retain a person who spent his time very robotically turning the right-hand nut or one nut on the right wheel of a truck someplace.
I knew a guy that worked at the Ford plant.
the truck plant.
Yeah. And made a lot of money. And I remember him calling in sick, you know, so they could go to a race in lacrosse and needed the day off and all. Anyhow, he was complaining about the job, and I'm going, well, what are you complaining about? You're getting paid a whole lot of money. And he says, well, Wayne, why don't you sit down on a stool and put in blinkers all day long, every day? And I thought, I could not do that.
That's a robotic job.
Yeah.
It turns out, just by accident, more or less.
And by the way, I didn't mean blinkers, the switch. I mean the light.
Yeah,
section.
One of the light assemblies,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that blinks.
It turns out that I was a consultant way back when I was at the University of Minnesota, because of my knowledge of vacuum tubes, to an outfit out in Connecticut. Where the president of that little company became known as the father of robotics. He finally asked me to sign some things, and then I helped him come up with a way for a new thing he was working on where he wanted to have a switch that said learn and then do. And it was called, they ended up calling it Unimate One. It was the first of the robotic things that could be placed alongside of a production line, put it in the learn position, have it do an operation, reach for something, put it someplace else, give it a turn, whatever it happened to be. It turns out that his Unimate One led General Motors to build a new factory, not in Detroit, but in New Jersey, to build the Vega, the Chevrolet, yeah, offsuit car,
yeah,
using heavily robotic production line. And while there were things wrong with the design of the Vega, mostly the aluminum engine that they put in it, the body itself, for example, One of the most terrible jobs that I saw in Detroit was the people who get inside of a shell of a body with air coming into a tube. Well, they got them a welder's mask on, and they're making continuous welds to hold the roof on the door frame, on the windshield surround, and all the rest of it, doing that 8 hours a day. Well, it turns out that the Unimate was able to do that same job and do it better and do it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Yeah, and I get it.
It worked just as well on Monday morning as it did on Friday.
I get it. Say, so did you hear about the guy who's riding along with his buddy, and he felt that perhaps he should pull over and check something out because he had a feeling that his blinkers weren't working? So he told his friend to get out and take a check and see if they're working. And he said, I'm going to do the left one. Are they working? He goes, yep, no, yep, no, yep, no. Now, that's an old joke, but at 11 before 11 on the Wayne Eddy Affair, my guest this morning is Don Anderson. He's been a guest of mine on many occasions. He is a retired professor of science and engineering. He has his doctorate degree in I don't know how many things. Question. I have an energy source for speakers, and it's a vacuum tube. Do you want to look at it? It should still work. I mean, are you fascinated by this? I've still got one.
No, as a matter of fact, this has always intrigued me. Again, I mentioned that word art. There are a number of people who decry the fact that modern digital semiconductor-based amplifiers don't give the same sound quality as the good old-fashioned 6V6 and 6LX6 vacuum tubes did. There was something about the resonances in the vacuum tube structure itself that made the sound very slightly different.
I've got an amplifier that you can even push a button and make it echo.
Mm-hmm.
And you can plug in a guitar. You can plug in microphones. It's got like 8 outs and ins. And if you would like, do you have like a huge garage where you tinker with toys and all that?
My garage, unfortunately, is too small for any cars to be in it because of what I do have in it.
Yeah.
But I no longer do any vacuum tube things. I don't have the testers or anything else anymore.
Oh, you don't even look at it, huh?
Nope. I moved. After I became the world's best expert in long-life vacuum tubes, the transistor came along, and I went with it into working with thin films and even quantum mechanical things. Because we got a few minutes left yet.
Well, we have to take a break.
Okay.
And then we'll come back, and you want to do a wrap-up of our lecture this morning?
That might be worth doing, because, again, my grandchildren need to know about it. My great-grandchildren need to know
and
about it.
And we're recording this.
Always.
And your great-grandchildren can listen to this recording when 25 years from now and say, great-grandpa was right, or great-grandpa was wrong, or that Rossi was quite the guy.
Who knows? We'll find out in 15. They'll find out in 15 or 20 years.
All right.
I don't think I'll be there.
I'll probably not either. We'll take this brief break and be back in 45 seconds.
Tackle your hunger the right way at the Quarterback Club in Northfield. Their juicy chicken, tender baby back ribs, and flame-broiled burgers are all made to order. For daily specials, quality food, and great prices, make it the Quarterback Club in Northfield.
This is Pastor Clark Carey, chaplain at Three Links Care Center in Northfield. Our mission statement is important to families, residents, and to us. It states, creating peace of mind for those we serve. To me, that means we care about every aspect of each person's life, body, mind, and spirit. Their physical, emotional, and spiritual needs are important to us in creating that peace of mind, so each is safe, secure, and loved under our care. Creating peace of mind for those we serve. That's our goal at Three Links.
The Wayne Eddy Affair continues at 8 minutes before 11 o'clock on this Monday. And this is the 8th day of January. And my father would have been 100 today, or 101.
And my mother would have been 100 today or 99. Can't remember which years. But I remember I had a grandpa that was born in the 1800s, and I thought, wow, that was so cool. How about you?
My father was born in 1899. He made it in under the wire.
Wow.
Unfortunately, he's also been gone for a long time.
Well, I assume you're 86, right?
86, working on the next one.
He's 10 years younger than me. Older.
Older.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, go ahead. Do a wrap of what we've been talking about, the ECAT QX, or Andre Rossi's invention, and what you perceive to be for real and ready in another two decades at the shortest.
Let's look forward in the future just a little bit. While my scientific background and my engineering practical background says that Rossi's invention is for real and that he really has financing for and is building factories to start mass production of a very inexpensive, tiny little device that can be a new source of energy that can last for centuries in terms of using up fuels. Until now, our old fire was all based on non-renewable or very slowly renewable resources like coal, oil, natural gas, wood, all of the others. Solar energy applications are great in that they don't produce carbon dioxide. They do produce a sizable fraction, but it's a small fraction of the energy that we use. The Rossi effect, which is called cold fusion or low energy nuclear reaction. I happen to like calling it the Rossi effect because nobody knows in detail why it works. I am convinced that it does work. The factories that he is building, one in Florida, one in near Stockholm in Sweden, should go operational around the end of 2018, certainly in 2019 at the latest. And the first applications will be for industrial process heat with his corporation going public, the IPO initial public offering probably happening in 2019, I believe. Not until those first factories are producing and selling all the product they can make. Two factories can't solve our problem. We're going to need factories in every state in the United States, and they're going to be big ones, and they're going to be heavily robotic, and they'll be using and reusing all resources with no apparent harm to the atmosphere or anything else. What will happen following that is a heavy modification of economics, politics, and even warfare. Based on this, getting back to warfare just for a moment, think of what happens with drones that can go up over a battlefield and stay up week after week after week because all the fuel they need is measured in grams, not in gallons of fuel. The difference in other areas, think of transportation. No question, trains ultimately will convert. Automobiles are changing anyway because of robotic artificial intelligence command and control. They may or may not have tires. They may or may not touch the ground. The generations to come will be faced with challenges and new opportunities and lost opportunities, which no longer will fit in that world of the future. The primary thing, yes, think of STEAM, science, technology, engineering, the arts, and mathematics. Those older people who are listening today, I'm telling you, if you have access to a young person, pay attention, watch what's happening. Just as a for fun example, don't let any young person say, I want to become a geologist specializing in oil. exploration. I don't think there's going to be too much demand for that, even 10 years from now.
Well, I'll tell you what, it sounds amazing. And obviously, we aren't going to be around to see if it comes to its conclusion. It also could be a big con job.
There is always, if it is, it's the biggest con job that I know of in my lifetime.
Okay. But it sounds exciting and reasonable in regards to how they're going to do that. But I want to know what happens, how we open the show, with all the mirrors in the desert and the reflection of the sun to a tower, that if a bird were to go between reflection to the tower, the bird would be annihilated. You wouldn't see anything. What is that for? Are they using energy off of that mirrored effort?
Oh, yes. It turns out there are something like 12 square miles of mirrors in the Mojave Desert by now, and a significant portion of that is shipped on a new major power line that was built, part of the investment that had to be made to feed electrical power down to the Los Angeles Basin from that area near the border between Nevada and California. Most of the area is really in California, but it's a long ways from there to Los Angeles. Just for the fun of it, I point out that birds are a problem, but I predict, because animals learn how to respond to our things. If a buzzard sees a smoking carcass of a bird on the ground between these mirrors, the buzzard will fly a mile away, land on the desert, and walk in under the mirrors to get his meal.
All right. His brother, probably.
Maybe his brother.
Well, thank you very much, Don Anderson, for sharing that with us. It's a process that certainly would be beneficial to mankind. And so, folks, put that in your memory. 20 years from now, you can say, wow, I heard that on the Wayne Eddy Affair. Or you'll probably go, I heard that on what? What was his name? Thanks again. All right.
It was a pleasure being here, Wayne.
All right. We are now going to join our Terry Knight for a book interview, like she does every Monday on KYMN. Northfield, Minnesota, 1080 on your AM dial for nearly 50 years, and 95.1 FM, The One.
It's time for 15 with the Author, hosted by Terry Knight. Join Terry as she opens the cover on a different book each week and talks with the author about their book, their life, and their message. Take a deeper look under the cover with Terry.
Our landscapes push aside wildlife and in turn diminish our genetically programmed love for wildness. How can we get ourselves back into balance through gardens to speak life's language and learn from other species? My guest today is Benjamin Vogt, who poses the questions and proposes answers in his new book, A New Garden Ethic, Cultivating Defiant Compassion for an Uncertain Future. Welcome to the show, Benjamin.
Thank you so much for having me on.
First, I have to ask, what do you mean by defiant compassion?
That's an excellent question, and certainly one others have asked. The defiant comes in the fact that we are in a period of mass extinction and climate change, and species are vanishing, and the world's weather is becoming more turbulent. And we live in a culture that works to deny those realities and to affect positive change. So you have to almost be defiant. And then the compassion comes in where, well, we need to start to take care of each other, and we need to take care of all the plants and the animals around us on the world if we're going to continue to survive and thrive on this planet. So that's the mix of defiance and compassion in the book.
I like that. Within the first couple of pages, you tell the story of the grasshopper and the spider, and it seems a metaphor for a new garden ethic. Can you explain that to our listeners?
Yeah, so I was feeding grasshoppers into a spider web, and at first I thought that was just so neat to see how the spider responded and how it, you know, injected the grasshopper. And then I thought, you know what, this is probably pretty gosh darn unethical. I'm literally killing one creature for the benefit of another without really understanding why. And I realized I was doing it just for my own pleasure. And I know it sounds kind of sick and twisted in a way, but I was privileging one species over the other, and that wasn't right.
Yeah, and it's hard for us to really kind of understand that when we don't have that closeness to wildlife, to the earth and the natural order of things either. I'm a gardener, and I love having my hands in the earth, and my thoughts on this have also evolved since getting into it. And in your book, you say in 2007 is when you and your wife started your garden. What was the catalyst that changed your thinking on gardens?
Well, I mean, I grew up with a mother who gardened, so I knew about gardening to a certain degree. But when I actually had the opportunity to have my own,